This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Corbin Addison uses his experience as a corporate lawyer to write about human rights stories in the developing world. His first novel, A Walk Across the Sun, followed two girls who were orphaned after a deadly tsunami and sold as sex slaves in Mumbai. His newest book, The Garden of Burning Sand, is set in Zambia, where an American lawyer working for an NGO fights to help a girl with Down syndrome who is raped and left to wander the streets. Corbin Addison will be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Wednesday, but first he joins me on the State of Things. Corbin, welcome. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Tell us, I want to hear more about how you used your background in corporate law, in fact, to create this story. Tell us more about that.
Sure. I mean, my background in law has given me kind of a context and training for what I'm doing now as an author and as an advocate. And, you know, to be honest, I went to law school because I love justice. It wasn't, you know, a desire of mine to work in corporate law, but I had to deal with the realities of debt, which is a common experience for law graduates, especially now. But nevertheless, you know, that desire to do justice in the world followed me through my practice. And as I was writing on the side as an aspiring novelist, I came across an idea at some point. It was my wife's, actually, to marry the two, to bring justice and storytelling together. And I did that with A Walk Across the Sun, as you mentioned, with human trafficking. And then after I had finished that story and was in search of a publisher, we came across some friends who were going to Zambia to start an organization working with kids with intellectual disabilities. And it was a sort of compelling issue because in Africa, unlike now in the United States, children with Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, autism have an 80% chance of dying before the age of five. Because they're considered cursed. They're not fed by their families. They're often not even allowed to see the daylight. When we heard about that, we thought, you know, that's an issue that should be revealed through fiction. But I didn't have a narrative until I came across another story. It was really serendipity from an organization we support that also works in Zambia. And it was a story of a girl with Down syndrome who was raped on the streets, sadly, a very common phenomenon in sub-Saharan Africa. And this organization came to the girl's aid and supported her and actually pressed for justice in a court system that really struggles with corruption and delay. And they were actually able to get a very rare conviction. And I thought that's a story I could tell in fiction and then bring it into, you know, sort of a broader world stage and make it a story more about gender-based violence writ large and not just about Zambia.
Well, tell us about the main character, Kuyeya. How much of her story do you know from the actual case, and how much of it did you have to then construct?
Yeah, I mean, what I did is I spent as much time as I could researching the real case. I mean, actually, when I was on the ground in Zambia, and of course, I go to every place that I set my story, hoping to live the story before I write so that the authenticity really bleeds onto the page. But I spent quite a bit of time with the lawyers who prosecuted her case, and these were actually civil lawyers, but they supported the local prosecutors. So I got access to her file, and I read it, and I talked to the people who supported her. And I drew from it as much as I found useful in the story. There were other elements, like Kuyeya's mother, that were entirely fictionalized, but again, based on factual stories of women in Zambia that I heard while I was there, and stories, you know, that I heard from other people telling me about women and their lives. So I try to construct my characters as much as possible. They're composite, but as much as possible from fact.
And now tell us more about Zoe, the American lawyer who is fighting this case. She has a backstory as well.
Yeah, I mean, I like the idea of taking Zoe from probably the polar opposite world from Kuyeya. So Kuyeya is from a poor family in Zambia, doesn't know who her father is, has Down syndrome, is living after her mother's death from AIDS, is living with an aunt, a friend of the family. Whereas Zoe, it comes from privilege, from a very upper crust New England family with lots of money, political power. Her father is a U.S. senator, running for the president of the United States. Her mother was an heiress who became a global philanthropist, sort of like Bill Gates in a female body, doing work specifically in Africa with a great passion for, using her wealth for good. And Zoe follows in her mother's footsteps, but is haunted by her mother's death on the one hand, and also by a betrayal by her father when Zoe was actually raped on Martha's Vineyard when she was a teenager. And that connection between Zoe's own past in privilege, but being raped in that place, is what initially draws her to Kuyea's story and really to the work in general of supporting children in Zambia who have been sexually assaulted.
And it's an important point to make because, as you said earlier, there's a high degree of likelihood that a woman might be assaulted on the streets of Lusaka. Statistically, that's true. But then we have to keep in mind that in the United States of America, one in four women on college campuses are sexually assaulted, and that sexual violence in this country has not abated, and in fact, in many cases, is domestic violence. So on the one hand, we have this picture about that kind of violence and corruption in Africa, but we shouldn't forget that that's not just an African phenomenon, right?
No, that's precisely right, and that's why I drew the story that way, because, of course, violence against women and girls is a global phenomenon. It's a human problem. It looks a certain way in the developing world, and it's exacerbated by poverty and corruption. But it is present anywhere men abuse women, and that exists everywhere in human society, sadly, leading people like Nick Kristof of the New York Times to call the oppression of women worldwide the great moral challenge of the 21st century. I happen to agree with him. I think that's exactly right. And so I really wanted to write a global story that wasn't just local to Zambia. It was global about this issue.
Can I ask you to read for us?
Sure, be happy to. So this is from two parts of the prologue, and I'll read a couple of paragraphs from each part. Lusaka, Zambia, August 2011. The girl walked alone on the darkened street. Lights moved around her as cars drove by, their headlights shining on the dusty roadway. But no one seemed to notice her or care that she was alone. Her gait was steady, but her steps were irregular, for one of her legs was shorter than the other. She was wearing a thin dress that offered little protection against the late winter chill. She felt the cold on her skin, but it concerned her less than the empty flat she had left. She looked back at the building where she lived. Lights were on in the windows. She could hear the blare of televisions over the sounds of traffic. She held her doll by the arm and stared at Annie's flat through the thick lenses of her eyeglasses. She didn't understand where Bright and Gifty had gone or why they had left her by herself. She didn't understand why they had forgotten to close the door. She turned back to the road and started off again, swinging her doll like a metronome. She heard music in the distance, and for a moment it distracted her. Then she saw a group of young people across the road. They were smoking cigarettes and talking loudly. Remembering Bright and Gifty, she took a step toward the tarmac, wondering if the smokers knew where they went. But a horn blast from a passing car stopped her in her tracks. She clutched the doll to her chest and glanced around again, rocking ever so slightly on her feet. Everything looked strange in the dark. Sometimes Gifty took her to another building to play, but she couldn't remember which way it was. The street didn't appear the way she remembered. She began to cry. She wanted the sun to rise and the strangeness of everything to go away. The night made her afraid. People lost their kindness when darkness fell.
Corbin Addison reading from his novel, The Garden of Burning Sand. He'll be reading at Flyleaf Books on Wednesday, but first with us on The State of Things. Tell us some more about these, about the lapses in justice and what makes getting a conviction so difficult in a country like Zambia.
The first obstacle is the justice system itself, the way that it was created by the colonists. In any post-colonial society that hasn't been fundamentally reformed, the challenge is the systems that were in place for just the dispensation of justice and politics and everything were created by the colonial powers to protect and insulate themselves against the native population. So when the colonists left a place like Zambia, so when the British turned it over to the Zambians in 1960, what happened is the justice system was just turned over to the elite Zambians, who then used the justice system to do exactly what the colonists did before, which is to protect themselves and their cronies against the ordinary Zambian. So if you're poor in Zambia, you're pretty much sunk. If you have a claim, it's not going to get heard. You don't have money for a lawyer. But beyond that, the court system is so backlogged that you really need more than just a lawyer. You need somebody who can do miracles in the system. And that costs a lot of money. And frankly, often it requires bribery and other things that ordinary people don't know. So that's the fundamental problem. Beyond that, you know, is just the simple fact that cronyism and corruption are very prevalent in places without a lot of oversight and without a lot of history of doing injustice on a large scale. And so, you know, you have situations where the police, most police and judges are not corrupt, but those that are often wield an inordinate amount of power and therefore make it very difficult for those honest cops and honest judges to do their work faithfully. And then you add in poverty and the simple fact that justice system is barely supported, if at all. I mean, police in Zambia, if you have a case, you actually have to pay the cab fare for the cop to come out to wherever the incident occurred because they don't have transport. And they often don't have guns issued to them. So if they actually want to arrest somebody, it's kind of hard to convince a hardened criminal to come along without a weapon. So, you know, you add all that together and what you get is a bit of a mess.
Yeah, well, then
a lot of good people trying.
Right. And if you didn't have cab fare, then you certainly don't have money to get the DNA evidence tested, which I understand is even more trying and more expensive, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and that's when I got to Zambia, that was the first thing that came to my mind. I started studying these cases and I thought, where's DNA in this? I mean, it's been available in the world since the 90s, DNA evidence. And of course, it revolutionized rape prosecutions in the United States and around the world as soon as it was available, because suddenly you have scientists coming to the jury and saying with a 99% certainty that this person was the person that deposited the sample that we got from this woman. And so I asked the lawyers who took this girl's case, where's DNA? And they immediately said, it's in South Africa. And I said, okay, well, South Africa is a long way away. That's expensive. Is DNA anywhere in the court system here? And they said, sure. I mean, we can pay for it, but we don't have the money. The courts won't pay for it themselves. It really is up to the client, once again, showing that poverty is a fundamental disability in the justice system there. So, you know, Lusaka happens to have all the infrastructure necessary to use DNA evidence if, in fact, there were a lab in the city. But because there is not, it's an overwhelming barrier to justice in these kinds of cases, largely because the evidence usually reduces to a few kids who might have seen something. And if you're a minor in Zambia, your evidence has to be corroborated by a person over 18, which immediately discounts the evidence in most of these cases to virtually zero. It's not going to meet the standard for justice, and that's a huge barrier.
So you talked about the legacy of colonialism, the fact that the colonial powers often created an elite class within the native population to act as a buffer between them and the rest of the populace. They may have been slightly more educated and probably had a little more wealth. That buffer group then becomes the elite class that becomes the ruling class, where the corruption now resides, or much of it. So what does that say then about the gap, the wealth gap, and the gender gap? And also, I think you mentioned the stigma of disability and disease in Africa that, again, is some of that is carried over as a legacy of colonialism.
Yeah, it is. Richard Dowden, who wrote sort of one of the great books on Africa, actually said that he used a metaphor, said that, you know, the colonial house was essentially the seat of government before independence in African countries. And when independence came, the colonists abandoned the colonial house. But then the elites that they had raised up, like you said, very, very eloquently, you know, to create a buffer between them and the sort of ordinary native population, just occupied the colonial house and then barred the door against the rest of the population. And that, you know, that continues to be a great challenge, though, thankfully, over time and with education, there is a rising, slow but still rising middle class in places like Zambia. And that, I think, is the key to the future. I mean, once a larger proportion of the population has an interest in seeing a justice reform happens because they want to be able to enforce their contracts and they want to be able to protect their children from rape and themselves from violence at the hands of people who otherwise would do it with impunity. That's when reform happens. It happened like that in the United States 100 years ago, and it will happen again, or will happen in Africa with the rise of the middle class. That's really what I see as the future in Africa.
How much of that, though, has to do with the NGOs there that have now kind of made a living out of Africa, right? And so as you point out in the book, this was a rare case in which an NGO was responsible for and a kind of a successful outcome in a terrible and a tragic case. Are we also seeing a time when, you know, sort of the role of the NGOs might be minimized and the, you know, the people of Africa can now take on some of these things that they are certainly more than capable of handling?
Yeah, I think, you know, the NGO in my story is a great example of the kind of partnership that I saw working very effectively in Zambia. And that is, it's an organization that is supported with Western money, but that's run by Zambians on the ground. And I've actually seen that in other places in the world. This particular group, the real-life organization, International Justice Mission, is out of Washington, D.C., but they work on violence against the poor around the world. And this particular office was run in every respect by Zambians, but supported from the outside. So that's the kind of, if you will, sort of native and then, you know, developed world NGO partnership that works very well. Eventually, that kind of partnership should be phased out, though I will note that in our globalizing age, more and more of the world is being interconnected so that we actually all have a stake in what happens, you know, in a place like Zambia. It may feel like a backwater to the average American, but for lots of reasons, it's not anymore. And so I think it's important for us to continue to invest, but at the same time, recognize that Africans and Zambians, they hold the keys to solve their own problems. They're the ones that understand those problems better than anyone else. But sometimes they need resources that may not be present in the local population, resources like money, experience, education. And those resources can be afforded by the developed world to the extent that, say, Zambians are willing and want to accept them.
Well, but it's a kind of double-edged sword, and I think it's just sort of outside the scope of your novel, but clearly you've given this a lot of thought. You know, one of the critiques is that NGOs have made this an industry, that while it makes perfect sense to see them in a position of offering resources to local individuals and phasing themselves out, from a survival standpoint, that's not what they're set up to do, and they're finding it very difficult to put themselves out of business. They're just too big, and they've institutionalized themselves. Man, how do you feel about that critique?
It's a fair one, and you know, certainly there are a lot of valid critiques of the aid program and the development program, and so I'm not going to dispute that. I'm obviously not an expert in development or aid, but you know, in my studies and my research, I've definitely come across that critique on the ground as well as theoretically, as you've posed it, and it's valid as far as it goes. I think, you know, individually, different NGOs are different. So, you know, you might have a critique of say, USAID, which is, you know, obviously a multi-billion dollar sort of aid arm of the U.S. government. And then, of course, they're supporting all kinds of local organizations, some that are more effective than others, some that are run more by the indigenous population and others run more by outsiders. So each individual organization is different. But I would say that generally speaking, the development program has worked to do a lot of good. Has there been waste? Absolutely. And is there a need for organizations to recognize when the event horizon is there for them to remove themselves? Yeah, absolutely. And that does go against human nature, as you point out. But nevertheless, that doesn't discount the value of what they've done and even what a lot of those organizations are still doing on the ground.
Corbin, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Corbin Addison's newest novel, The Garden of Burning Sand, going to be at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill on Wednesday. Just ahead, the front man for the Holy Ghost Tent Revival, Stephen Murray. His new album will be featured here on The State of Things. Stay tuned.
To the ceiling, empty walls, empty floors, and not much more.